Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your health and well-being and our total environment, everything going on in our communities, in our society, and on the earth. For the last 4 years, we've been on Connect the Dots, bringing you thought leaders, experts, advocates, authors, doctors, scientists, policy experts, and a whole host of people talking about all of the different facets of things that are going on in our world that affect us, our well-being, and the life on this planet. So for the last 3 months, actually it's going on 4 months at this point because we are now in the month of May. Happy May, everybody. We've been covering the trade deals, as I call them, the fast-tracked trade deals. These are treaties, trade agreements that the government is putting forth, and we've been educating you to them for just about a year at this point, more intensively over the last 4 months. When you began hearing the programs that we've run on these topics, you may have thought, oh, why are we focusing on this? And now, of course, it's all over the news. It's all over the mass media. This program, along with my blogs on Alternet and Truthdig, were among the first places where you could get an orientation to what's been coming up for us now. And right now, we're right in the thick of it. We've been predicting, you know, it would be hitting around in April and into May, and here we are, and we've been reporting on it every week. So glad that you're following the story with us. Today, I'm very excited to have someone who can really discuss this whole issue from a completely different and new angle. We've talked to environmental experts. We've talked to people about the food issues involved. We've talked to all kinds of different advocates about the issues with these treaties, as well as, you know, why they're being proposed and what's going on behind the veil of secrecy. Today we're going to be speaking with someone who has great expertise in the trade issue itself and the economics behind it, and in what constitutes an effective versus an ineffective economic strategy for our society. Our guest today is Michael Stumo. He is the Chief Executive Officer of the Coalition for a Prosperous America. It's a coalition of agricultural, manufacturing, and organized labor associations, companies, and individuals. CPA works for policies to balance U.S. trade, maintain U.S. sovereignty, which is a big issue with these treaties, and develop an effective national production and economic strategy. Michael's own background is in farming, and he also is a lawyer and an attorney, so he brings a very diverse expertise and experience to our discussion today. So happy to have you with us today and Connect the Dots. Welcome, Michael Stumo.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Allison.
So, you know, let me, you know, we've been talking about the treaties and, you know, any listeners who are not kind of acquainted with the trade agreements we're talking about, this is the Trans-Pacific Partnership and TTIP, which is the Atlantic and European trade deal, and both of these are shuttling into our federal legislature. They're in the Senate at this recording. They'll soon be going to the House, most likely, for a quick passage by something called Fast Track, which is a form of a legislation that grants the president, President Obama, authority to sign these treaties without their full provisions being made known. Nevertheless, there have been leaks, as we've reported on the show, repeatedly, and more is known about them in terms of some of this, many of the specifics, as well as we also have the history of previous deals and, you know, how successful they've been in fulfilling the promises that have been offered about them versus the reality of what has happened. So, you know, let me ask you, Michael, from your perspective, you know, are these trade deals good for our economy, jobs, you know, just to start? Is this the right economic strategy for our country to be engaging with at this time, you know, based on what you see about the deals as well as past experience?
No, they are not. The trade deals, of course, cannot in and of themselves be the entire country's economic strategy or the entire trade policy. They are a subset of trade policy, which is then a subset of economic strategy if we had it. But the trade agreements have just focused on pursuing sold under a rubric of free trade, but what they've produced is really the opposite of free trade in that we've had record trade deficits in which we import more than we export. We have offshored and deindustrialized huge swaths of our economy, not only low tech, but medium tech and high tech and green tech. As we lower, you know, just strictly from an economic perspective, as we have lowered our barriers, our tariffs, our quotas, and the like, other countries have lowered some of theirs, but replaced them with other barriers, like manipulating their currency values downward, which is the same as a subsidy of their exports to us and a tariff on our sales to them. They increase border taxes, so they lower tariffs and increase border taxes, so our goods pay the same at the border as before, even though theirs don't. And there's massive industrial subsidies, especially with the former communist countries and existing communist countries, that we pretend that they are going to free trade, but they're not, and they're subsidizing immensely. So we end up with a low-end service economy, unemployment, wage stagnation, income inequality, and the like.
And yet, this is not the presentation. There is actually, just recently, as we talk here on the air, there's been a Huffington Post article in which some of the Democratic representatives and senators are responding to accusations by President Obama that they are, you know, not they don't have a grasp of the issue, or they're not telling the truth. And you know, one of the difficulties has been for the the treaties are not transparent to the public. We can't see them, and it sounds like with a number of things that they contain, we need to be seeing them to assure that our interests are represented. And further, even though they are available to our elected officials, our congressional and senatorial representatives, it is under such a sort of a challenging protocol to view a complex and highly legalistic document without being able to take a single note or run it past your analyst, your legislative analyst, that's a specialist in any of these areas, to talk with economists. So it's a lot of people, a great many members of Congress, very few have actually read the agreements. They're relying upon, talking points and memos and assurances from the U.S. Trade Representative who's negotiated them. And in today's Huffington Post, one of the senators says, you know, what's under the hood is different from what's being promised. Can you contrast for our listeners, what we're being told about these treaties by, you know, the U.S. Trade Representative and others who strongly support them? We're being told they will accomplish, and what actually history has shown, or even details of the agreements that we know reveal will not be happening. I mean, what's the difference between what we hear and what's actually contained therein and the effect that will have?
Well, the big issue is economic growth and job creation. This administration and prior ones, Bush 2 and Clinton, promised huge number of jobs and economic growth. The opposite occurred. This agreement is just a rerun of the others, with some, slightly different provisions here and there. But the big issue is that the U.S. Trade Representative, Michael Froman, formerly of Citigroup, will only talk about the export side of things. They will not talk about the import side. When we visit with policymakers here at CPA, Coalition for a Prosperous America, we say, look, we're okay with trade. We don't, you know, we're okay with it. And we're, in fact, we're pro net exports. In other words, exports exceeding imports. Where we differ with Michael Froman is he's only pro gross exports and doesn't want to talk about the other side of the equation. And further, and
Michael, isn't that a little bit like talking about your income without talking about your expenses when you drop a budget?
Well, sure. I'm sure if Michael Froman talked to the Citigroup board, I don't know if he, you know, what extent he did, but he only talked about Citigroup's income, said we're pro-commerce. And look, we've got, you know, more income than, you know, we had 5% more income than last year. But if expenses went up by 10 or 15%, and he omitted that, that question A would come up. And if he didn't answer it, they'd find someone who could. So, you know, that's in terms of economic growth. So you can be our group is we have left of center, including labor and others. We have right of center, including many manufacturers, and we have everything in between. And so we all agree on these issues. It's a very broad ideological coalition. This is an American issue, not just a, you know, a left or a right issue. But, of course, the Republicans have tended to support more, so we've actually focused on the Republicans more than the Democrats just because labor and environmental groups and others have, you know, worked very hard with the Democrats. But if you are talking to a Republican and you can say, look, you know, you can't be pro-growth and support these deals because the trade deficits subtract from our GDP, gross domestic product growth. We, of course, had the first quarter of this year, we had no growth because exports were down and imports were up in our country. So the trade deficit, we will say, and is which is true, is not just an interesting, geeky, ancillary economic statistic. It is core. Why? If the simple GDP, gross domestic product, we think, well, what does that mean? That is the, you know, it's not the best measure. It's not the only measure. There are faults. You've got to have other things. I understand. But let's just take it on its own right for a second. It is the total product, the total amount of things produced in a country like ours. And they just add up four things. They add up first, personal consumption, what people buy as consumers, they consume. Second is investment. That means investing, buying things like plant and equipment, things that make other things. Third is government as consumer. So we've got three things for the product, personal consumption, investment, and government. And the fourth is net trade, meaning if exports are over imports, that adds to GDP. If imports are more than exports, that subtracts from GDP. So when we've had 40 years of consistent trade deficits, ever since the modern fast track era has started in 74, 40 straight years of trade deficits, which has subtracted growth from our country every year. And that compounds. If we're 2% less this, you know, last year and 2% less this year, we're 2% less than the 2% less, you know, and then the prior 3% less or whatever. So it compounds. And so if you are pro-growth, you have to be pro-net exports and not just pro-growth exports. And that's very hard for them to. You know, they often get it, sometimes they don't, but there just is no comeback for that. And so our trade deals have caused net imports and economic shrinkage, and our economy is much, much smaller than it would otherwise have been if we simply had a strategy to balance trade over time.
That's very serious.
I hope I didn't get too wonky, but...
No. That's why you're here, because this is, you know, I report on food, health, and the environment. And, you know, that's a very, I mean, I find it a very comprehensible explanation. So you know, you're saying, I mean, and you know, in your whole explanation, you said that this is something that, you know, because a lot of my listeners may not, you know, they probably are like me in not having that strong economic business background. But, you know, so in any company in Wall Street, you're not entitled to kind of just pick and choose which things that you're going to consider. It would be agreed among all business people of any stripe, and not, you know, it's not an advanced scientist or some kind of strange different theory. Everyone would agree, if they were operating any kind of company or business, that you have to look at the things that you're describing. You have to look at the range and what the bottom line is at the end of the day, rather than looking at one item and saying, looking good, without taking these other things into account. So, you know, why then, I mean, why then is anyone in favor of this? Why are the businesses that are, you know, involved or supporting it in favor of it, if it's going to be, as you're describing, and has been, a severe economic drain on the American economy? Why does anyone want to do this? Why are they proposing it even?
Well, just to double down on what you just said, if a company, you know, if Apple reports its profit is its income minus its expense. So that's what profit is, and that's where it share goes. So net trade is the analog, which is our exports minus our imports, and you can't just look at one thing.
Right.
So what you basically, you have, it's really a, I think I look at it as a three-legged stool that is promoting the trade agreements, and there's a, I would argue, and I think I'm right, that even the multinationals shouldn't support these because they are debasing the consumer power of the U.S., the biggest consumption market in the world. So I think, you know, if we really went through it, you know, and sat in a closet for 2 hours and really went through it, they would question where they're at. But the three-legged stool is, one, the multinationals who like who get an advantage by going to other countries that not only have cheap labor, which is actually a minority part of it, but also do other subsidization and currency manipulation and things so that they can produce cheaper and take advantage of the subsidies in the other country and re-export to the U.S. consumer market and get an advantage. So that's the multinational, and that's the closest thing, you know, the multinational greed part that we always hear about. The second leg is the diplomats, the State Department. Diplomats look at these trade agreements as ways to gain friends internationally. And certainly with the TPP, they want this as somewhat of a counter to China, which doesn't make any sense, but we can go into that if you like.
Yeah, we need to discuss the Chinese thing, but yeah, let's make your first point first. Yeah.
And the third leg is the economists. The economists who are relying, who've never read the agreements, who haven't tracked the results really, but simply have only read their textbook on, you know, free trade theory, and believe that a 2,000-page document that says free trade on the front is parallel to their economics textbook that says free trade, and they don't need to read it.
Oh my God!
So it's as smart as they are, they're not very smart here because they don't get how these agreements differ from their textbook. They're just commenting on free trade as a theory when they comment on these agreements, and free trade, I know what. There's one multinational I won't name, but that's kind of opposed to these, and they've been selling congressional offices. Look, there's free trade and there's free trade agreements, and they're not the same thing, and that's true.
What's the difference between them?
Well,
just
it's
briefly.
Managed,
yeah.
You know. Well, let me put it this. I personally don't think you can achieve free trade among different nations with different fiscal policies, different regulatory systems, different currencies, and the like. You can have free trade within, for example, the U.S. 50 states, But if you were going to have one country and go fully global, let's say, and we mm-hmm. have this one country called, you know, whatever you want to call it, one country that has the same fiscal policy, the same regulatory, the same labor market, the same currency, you've got to have all of those. Otherwise, you can manipulate things like your fiscal policy or your currency policy or your regulation or other things. And just breaking down barriers doesn't do it. So number one, free trade, I don't think works between countries. But here, what happens is that when we drop our so-called barriers, whether it's tariffs or other things, and other countries might do the same reciprocally, they replace them, those barriers, as I mentioned before, with devaluing their currency for a trade advantage, by upping mm-hmm. their taxes at the border, by subsidizing their industry. So if you have a domestic manufacturer, like would be in our coalition for Prosperous America, they'll tell me, look, I can compete against the other companies in other countries, but I can't compete against their governments. When their government gives unlimited subsidies and devalues their currency, that's just something I can't contend with. And mm-hmm. the only way we can do it is to have our government help neutralize it. So it's a different tack, but it's true. When China devalues its currency by 40%, that means everything Chinese is on sale economy-wide by 40%. But it mm-hmm. also means when we sell to them, it is as if they erected a 40% tariff, which the free traders would otherwise go, you know, crazy about. But when it's currency devaluation with the same economic effect, they don't, and it's inconsistent. And it's not sideline fringe economics, it's mainstream economics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So basically, what the deals are attempting to do is, you know, pretend that we're all one big country where we have all the same laws, where we have the same currency, and then this whole notion of barriers to trade is basically stripping down anything that is different between this country or its currency or this one or this one, or this country's healthcare system or this country's regulations or this country's laws or this country's labor practices. So there's this kind of attempt, but it's a selective attempt, apparently, to strip away some of these things with the idea that somehow you could create some kind of uniform playing field. But that's a big, I mean, you know, that's like performing brain surgery or total body surgery all at once on, you know, I don't know, 40 different countries, you know, and there are risks involved when you do that extensive a surgery that you haven't calculated correctly for the ramifications or the downsides or the fact that somebody will have an out and slip through and not do it. I mean, you know, how can you possibly project everything that would need to be projected to A, either accomplish what you're trying to accomplish, or B, assure that it doesn't have a whole, host of very destabilizing unintended consequences.
Right, and certainly we know the consequences now. So, the old David Ricardo, was a English. You know, English guy in the early 1800s who wrote about things like comparative advantage and free trade and all that. And mm-hmm. he was writing against this thing called mercantilism. We've heard mercantilism, even though we don't necessarily know what it means. Mercantilism is countries gaming the international trading system for their advantage to gain a trade surplus every year, every year, every year. And mm-hmm. that's what England and France and the old, you know, world powers tried to do. And he wrote against it, saying that, you know, that was wrong. It should be free trade. They shouldn't game the system and all the like. Well, what we're doing, we're enabling modern mercantilism in which countries game the system. And actually, even though U.S. is still sort of a putative superpower, we are taking the brunt of it in trade. The point is that free trade was supposed to produce balance. You know, some years you'd be a little surplus, some years you'd be a little deficit. When we have 40 years of deficit, that is a leaking of jobs, but it's also a leaking of trillions of dollars of money out of our economy that would otherwise mm-hmm. be put to productive use and would pay tax dollars and the like. Mm-hmm. Huge amounts of industries that are otherwise competitive, and when they move, we get off the innovation ladder, so our innovation stops. It starts somewhere else where the industry relocates, which is a big deal. So it's very hard to go and hit, oh, this little mercantilist or trade cheating tactic and that one, because it's like whack-a-mole. You knock one down after 3 years of negotiations and four more pop up, and you've got 6 mm-hmm. years of negotiations to hit those. So what mm-hmm. do you do with that? Well, what we've proposed is, well, if you like free trade, or if you like fair trade, or if you like smart trade, or whatever you call it, everyone agrees that global imbalances are wrong. In other words, globally, some countries always have a surplus, some countries always have a deficit. So let's go for the actual goal, which is relative balance over time. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you do with that? Well, we figure it out, but we set the goal of balance, and then we use tools to make sure it balances. Maybe it's by hitting the big, big mercantilist track tactics of the day, like I discussed, or maybe it's gas putting up a tariff to neutralize a whole host of those tactics that we can't otherwise get to, but we produce a result of balanced trade, which is what free trade is supposed to be. And oh, by the way, it wouldn't end up hollowing out our economy and sending our jobs overseas. It would be balanced, but we wouldn't be, you know, growing on, you know, on someone else's back. For example, China and Taiwan and the like are growing on the back of the American consumer as we hollow out our economy. That's mm-hmm. not the way it should work. So that's why, you know, we propose balanced trade, and actually the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which is about 70 further left of center within the Democratic Caucus, have agreed to balanced trade as a core principle for them, and we're getting some receptivity on the right as well, because it makes economic sense, and again, it's not wacko, it is pretty mainstream stuff. We just have lost sight of it.
Well, let me ask a question. You know, one of the big issues under this rubric is currency manipulation. And, you know, Senator Charles Schumer, for example, and others have said that to allow this in and not address the currency manipulation issue, which you described in terms of, you know, a very key factor that's being used and hurting us, countries are doing that. You know, he's fighting for that, and he's saying if we could put in stipulations about that, we might have something there. So I have two questions for you. One, do you think correcting that would make for an improvement that would make the rest of the treaties tolerable? And two, why can't that happen? Because it's basically been a no-go, apparently.
Fixing currency manipulation globally is necessary, but mm-hmm. it's insufficient. So mm-hmm. I think that encapsulates it. It's necessary but insufficient, because there are other ways to game the system, and they want mm-hmm. they should have an analysis that in an expeditious way roots out all other ways that they game the system to basically, and this is actually trade agreement language, the parties shall not do other things to nullify and impair the benefits expected of the agreement. That's what mm-hmm. they do. And we can actually use their trade treaty words against them. Look, they're nullifying and impairing the benefits expected, and you're doing nothing. And they signed on the dotted line, and so did we. So the short answer is the Schumer et al. Currency fight is really big. It's really important. It's necessary, but it's insufficient to fully fix things. And I think our group, which is a broad coalition, would start having I don't think we would support these trade deals just with currency in them. But Schumer's bill actually is a domestic law that we would be able to put up countervailing duties against countries that manipulate, and that's independent from the trade agreement. So we would favor just having our domestic law doing it, but not, that would be outside the scope of the agreements.
Mm-hmm. And that would correct existing agreements, whether this one were signed or not, basically, as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, anybody who manipulates their currency, that would be considered a subsidy, a foreign mm-hmm. subsidy, which, mm-hmm. Standard trade types don't like, subsidies that at all, and you can countervail or put a tariff or duty to neutralize that subsidy. So if the subsidy was a 30% subsidy, you put a 30% countervailing duty or tariff on to bring the product back up to what's called fair value. That's a non-controversial mm-hmm. issue. What's controversial is calling currency manipulation a subsidy like anything else.
What about healthcare? Is that a subsidy? Because I have heard from healthcare practitioners, in other developed countries about their concerns that their lower cost, better care, more functional healthcare systems than the one we have here in the U.S. Could be kind of sabotaged by the agreements both because the health care they provide or their price controls, that help keep it, at a cost-effective rate, that could be viewed as an unfair subsidy by that government, even though it's protecting its own citizens and assuring that people get health care, which is sounds like a good idea. Could things like that, could that, for example, be taken down as being an unfair subsidy? How far do these treaties go in leveling the playing field? Would they go so far as to strip away another country's better healthcare system?
I think under current trade law, they could not. I think it is a subsidy, but not in the negative way. Our current trade agreements could never do anything about it. And
what about these new ones? When you say current, would that be including the new ones?
Even the new ones, they wouldn't touch it. They never would. Mm-hmm. We'll never get at that. And that's actually an example of, I say, fiscal policy. Fiscal policy means a government's ability to tax and then spend its money on, good or bad things, as the case may be. And in this case, they're mm-hmm. taxing and spending it on national health care.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to use trade agreements to get into fiscal policy. It just won't go there. So mm-hmm. it's a way, trade agreements can't level the playing field in that sense, because you can't get so deep into other countries' domestic policy, fiscal policy, to root out all those other, cost discrepancies.
Mm-hmm.
What we've been talking about, what other countries have tended to do, I said they put up border taxes. Mm-hmm. They're usually called value-added taxes. In Canada, mm-hmm. it's called the Goods and Services Tax, GST. Mm-hmm. That is a tax on consumption. What they've tended to do as countries in the last 40 years have added these VATs, VAT is a tax on consumption. They can also tax incoming goods that are consumed. So it's a tax that can go on the border. They have done two things, reduced some income taxes. They've also added benefits like pension and health care benefits, like national mm-hmm. health care. So what happens is, the average VAT around the world is 17%. So most of our exports shipped to other countries pay on average 17% at the border, even though it's not called a tariff.
Mm-hmm.
So our goods, let's say Germany is 20% approximately VAT. A $50,000 Ford Explorer sent to Germany will pay $10,000 in tax at the border.
Mm-hmm.
So that Ford Explorer carries our U.S. tax load, the medical costs of the Ford workers,
mm-hmm.
then it pays the German tax load, which also pays the medical costs of the German workers in the mm-hmm. Mercedes plant that it's competing against.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something they don't even talk about in trade. It's a huge deal, and you can't ferret it out because it's legal under the WTO to put that tax on the border. We've actually suggested something kind of radical, but it's mainstreaming slowly, which is, what if the U.S. does its own consumption tax, put in a consumption tax, drastically reduce the income tax side in a way that maintains progressivity? In other words, that rich pay more and the poor pay less, which you can do. And then we'll tax the incoming Chinese and German goods, and they can pay our taxes. Because the thing about a consumption tax is, when German's Mercedes $50,000 vehicle, SUV, is exported, because that vehicle will not be consumed in Germany, the $10,000 VAT on it that's embedded in the cost will be rebated, and the government sends Mercedes a $10,000 check, so it comes out at $40,000, so it's like a subsidy. But if we could tax it coming in, I know this is a lot to swallow, I'm sorry, but it's a big deal, and it shows why we can't level the playing field. We say, let's tax the German goods like we do, like they do us, and reduce some of our others, and maybe in the future, you know, we can discuss getting the healthcare costs off the employer back and having some form of, you know, national health care that comes through that system. We haven't been willing to take that on yet because of the controversy of Obamacare. But anyway, you know, it's illustrative.
What about, you know, one of President Obama's principal arguments here has been, you know, if we don't do this, we're going to be done in by China. We're going to be out of the game, and these treaties will keep us in the game so that, you know, China doesn't take over and wipe out our economy.
Yeah, he says that if we don't write the rules of trade in Asia, China will. Two points. Number one, we already heard, this is a rerun, we already heard that argument when the debate about China joining the WTO was occurring 15 years ago, in 99 and 2000. So China will now play by the rules. They'll join the WTO, which is a multilateral trade agreement that covers most of the world. And we, as the U.S. and the Western countries, wrote that agreement. They're signing on, and they are now going to agree and abide by Western written rules of international trade. Apparently, that didn't work out really well, because they're justifying it now with an agreement that doesn't include China. So if that didn't work, what went wrong, and what's different here, and how are you going to fix what went wrong before? They don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, no, that's let's talk about it here. That's what I'd like to know.
Yeah. So, what have you done to see what went wrong? Let's bullet point it, and then show us in this new trade agreement what you've done to correct it, and why will it affect China if they're not a signatory? Secondly, at the core, really, is relative economic strength.
Let's address the first question first, because you bullet-pointed that, but you didn't address it. So let's not go through all the bullet points. Let's just go say the bullet point and then answer that, and then we'll go on to the next one. That'll be easier for people to follow.
My points are only two. I mean, what I was saying is, if they thought something went wrong and they're going to correct it, show us how.
How do they propose to correct it? Yeah.
All they say is a rhetorical point that we want to write the rules for Asia, and it hasn't been plumbed down into at all in relation to the, you know, when they said it before. So it just, the debate never has gone there at a national level.
I see.
So I don't know what their answer would be, because they've never had to answer that question.
So they're just promising to do it, but there's no idea of how they would do it. With China not in the TPP, not in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, what is the concept there? Are they going to do something, and then by virtue of what they do inside the treaty, it's going to contain China? I mean, what is the theory by which this is, you know, with China not in the agreement, how is that agreement supposed to help?
It doesn't make any sense. Once you start thinking beyond the sales talking point, it doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I can't answer that question.
Okay. That's exactly, I'm not following it very much either, but I just wanted, and I'm sure many people aren't, but so what's your second bullet point? Let's go back to the bullet points about why, if it didn't work before, it's not going to be that stellar now.
Well, my overall point is the TPP is irrelevant to really China and, writing the rules of trade and or containing China. It's really irrelevant. Because it's not going to write the rules of trade for Asia because China's not in it, and because they tried before, and that it's just not what happens to make us stronger as an economy and as a global superpower. It's just we did it; it didn't work, and doing it without China isn't going to work. Secondly, the core is that China gets its influence as a very fast growing. Modernizing economy that's growing largely on the back of the U.S. consumer because we have a $350 billion per year trade deficit with them. That means U.S. dollars on net, we are funding them at $350 billion a year, which is money and income they get that they don't have to tax their citizens for. They can grow many industries on that. They can build their military, which is becoming very worrisome, and they're being very aggressive in the South China Sea and the East China Sea and the like. And they can use that money to buy friends around the world by investing in infrastructure. They've got the new Asia Development and Infrastructure Bank they're putting together to rival the World Bank. They're buying friends in Africa. They're buying friends in Asia. Sometimes they're not great friends because they don't, there's some strings attached, but the money's big. So they want to build a canal across Nicaragua to rival and they actually operate the Panama Canal now. They own a lot of the major strategic seaports around the world. They use their state-owned enterprises as tools of government policy to buy, other resources and mining interests around the world. And it's because of the trade deficit, the $350 billion that we send them, that is money they wouldn't otherwise have, that weakens our economy, strengthens theirs. This isn't anti-China. They just have, Japan was the big issue in the 80s. China's a big issue now. It's just the numbers. I mean, they're doing what's in their strategic interests. Shame on us for not doing what's in ours. Is the issue, but I don't blame them at all. But the core issue is some sort of a trade deal with Brunei and some other countries that we already have trade deals with now is not going to change the overall dynamics where we are a shrinking or stagnating economy with a deficit funding the growth of others who are challenging our role in the world because of the flat-out economic strength. So you've got to address the trade balance in order to turn around our economy and thus our ability to be a leader in the world.
So instead, this is driving the bus down the already severe downhill trend that we've been on.
Right. I mean, these trade agreements will continue the deindustrialization and the economic shrinkage that we've already seen that have very little to do with low labor rates elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you cannot grow our economy unless you fix trade. You can't put people back to work.
And this, instead of fixing it, would be extending the problem further.
Right. We've got a hole and we're still digging.
Right. You know, one of the things that I hear from a lot of people who are either kind of, well, if the president is suggesting this, he's a good guy and it must be a good idea. Or, what we've heard, for example, from Hillary Clinton's recent comment on the treaty, it sounds quite equivocal. But in making, you know, in other words, what she said was so politically conjigged that you couldn't actually really tell whether she was in favor of it or not. But by saying nothing, it implies that she was basically in favor of it. So I think some people feel that, it, you know, that if we kind of coast along as we are, there'll be, you know, a sort of things may either, let's hope, correct themselves, or there may be a very slow downhill drift. Do you feel that we're at risk for a more precipitous decline if these treaties are enacted?
Yes, certainly. Hillary Clinton was pro-NAFTA, and depending on the crowd she talks to, she's, you know, for the trade deals or equivocating, as she did publicly.
Right.
President, you know, we know Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown are on a different side from President Obama. The people that are driving it in the administration, he wasn't really well-formed, I don't think, when he gained to be president. He's a constitutional lawyer. Trade wasn't his thing. But, of course, when you're president, you deal with all kinds of issues. He hired people like Tim Geithner, Michael Froman, Jacob Lew, Larry Summers, all of who have, you know, very strong Wall Street financial industry ties, and they really are sort of driving the boat and have apparently made a good case to him. But the way a modern diverse economy, you know, works is you want to have, you know, a lot of different industry supply chains happening, and you can't just rely on services like insurance and banking. You know, everybody's not going to be a banker. You want to have a lot of different industrial industries, and I don't mean smokestacks, because most of them aren't smokestacks now. Unless you offshore them, then they become polluting smokestacks again, because we've kind of regulated that. And those industries produce jobs at every level of the supply chain. They produce tax revenue. They produce, you know, wealth creation for the business owners. They produce a lot of innovation, and they spin off a lot of jobs. They produce, depending on the industry, 5 to 16 other jobs, which are service sector jobs. And so when you have a supply chain for IBM or for an Intel or for cell phones or for anything, they tend, once you start picking apart that supply chain and globalizing it, it gets an ecosystem collapse. It's like a, you know, a tipping point, an ecosystem collapse, and it all goes away. Even though, you know, American interests may own something, but it's mostly offshore. And so you lose all those jobs, all the innovation, all the secondary jobs that were created by it. So yes, we, you know, is it slow downhill? Will there be a tipping point and a real collapse? I don't know. We're still the world's reserve currency. That helps us a lot. But we certainly are teetering on the brink of second-class economy status, whereas Japan and Germany, which is a high-wage, highly unionized economy, focus very heavily on being a high-tech, high-wage, strong manufacturing economy. And it's something, you know, you can't develop into a global player, if that's what you want to be, but the core is to improve standards of living for your citizens on a consistent basis. You can't do that with a diverse array of, you know, industries that spin off the other jobs, like the insurance and the haircuts and the restaurants and the, you know, the financiers. And there's no other path to, you know, being a modern economy that's been seen so far, and we're squandering it because of trade agreements.
Have you... Thank you. I think that's really crystal clear and very sobering and disturbing analysis. You know, on prior programs, we've discussed some of the ramifications via the investor-state dispute resolution that could have impact on our ability to regulate, to pass local laws and ordinances, to do things that are health-oriented. So there's a whole other layer of worry.
Yeah.
But what you're describing, you know, and that's kind of, all of that is sort of solidly in my regular beat, and I'm kind of expanding and learning into your area. But, you know, in addition, we have all of the problems there of loss of sovereignty and loss of the hands on the levers to deal with issues like climate change, pollution, food supply. You know, these are not small things either. But you know, what you've told us on today's program is really that the engine that is really the main point of, supposedly the main point of all of this, is extremely faulty and is going to be driving the bus in the wrong direction further downhill. So, you know, from my perspective and that of most listeners to this program, these other sort of corporate overrule takeover aspects to these agreements are, you know, kind of make this treaty a Trojan horse. So you bring in a so-called treaty, and then it has all of these other provisions, and the provisions are secret, and the whole thing is then rushed through Congress without anyone being able to really examine these things more closely. You know, all of that makes it, it's not a really about being a treaty, it's really about being a Trojan horse for these other things that are very undesirable from the public perspective for people who really understand the implications of them, which we're just beginning to understand because of, you know, the secrecy of some of these provisions, and there may be further ones that we don't even know about. But what you're saying is that the basic, you know, driving direction of this sheerly from an economic point of view, which is what this is supposed to be for, is completely off base to begin with. So, you know, with those two things put together, you know, I have to ask, why does any, I mean, I understand why the companies involved might regard this as an advantage, but why, and I understand that, you know, there are participants in our Congress who have various agendas, some of which may not be that helpful to the American people. But, you know, but I think people have a tremendous difficulty understanding why the president, you know, would be doing this or be a proponent of this, or why would anyone want to drive, you know, our economy downhill? Even the companies involved, why would anyone want to do that?
Well, I think you're right. You know, the ISDS, global court system, and the environmental and all that, all those non-trade items that have been stuck in here in these global governance agreements, which it is what it is, it's global governance, they're bad. And they're reason in and of themselves to reject it. But even if you just stuck to the trade stuff and you know, and tried to, and did these just with the trade things, you still would be, the theory is faulty. So these things are rotten at the core, even if you strip out, you know, the ancillary items to trade, which is regulating our other domestic policy. You have a very strong, you have a variety of, I have a hard time articulating the arguments of the other side because I find them so distasteful and illogical. But you'll have kind of libertarians or even the so-called, well, let me say one more thing. A lot of our members are companies who supported CAFTA. The president of my board or the chairman of my board supported CAFTA. And some of our trade association members did. Now they've turned around, and that's partly why we are in a better position than we have been in the past, because former supporters have been jumping to the other side, some through joining our group, saying, look, the promises didn't work out. But, the you know, Cato Institute, for example, will say, which is a libertarian think tank, we'll say, look, if other countries subsidize and give us cheap consumer goods, we'll just take advantage of it and we'll redeploy our resources elsewhere instead of spending on those goods. Well, that sounds very attractive at first blush, but if you put so many people out of work and you disable the wealth and income and job-creating power of the country, even if you have cheap goods, you have undercut the purchasing power of our populace so much that the goods ultimately are more expensive because we don't have employment or we have minimum wage jobs that we can't buy the cheaper goods anyway. If you look at back, you know, our first industrial policy was Alexander Hamilton, which people have divergent views about, but they put together a plan. Our early in our country, we could have just bought cheap European industrial goods instead of spent all that money and headache and effort putting together our own industry. It would have been cheaper in the short run, but we wouldn't have employed people. We would have still been, you know, an agrarian African colony-like scenario that could not have moved up the development ladder as a country to eventually become, you know, a superpower. Whether you like us being a superpower or not, at least we got, you know, longer lives and improvements in standards of living and the like in, along with it. But we would have been, we would have been a colony, you know, without being a colony, without an economy, just a little bit. So they built industry here, and that remains true here. You've got to balance production and wealth creation and income and jobs with cheap prices. You can't only consume, but you can't only produce. There has to be balance, and they don't really get that. And it's hard to put in a soundbite, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what I hear you saying is that, you know, the wheel has come off the hub a bit, and some of these ideologies are really getting in the way. In any case, we're coming into the last minute or so of our program, and I just want to thank you so much. Can you tell our listeners, if they want to read more, how they could access some more of this information that you've been sharing with us today, Michael Dumo?
Well, our website is prosperousamerica.org. Coalition for Prosperous America is the organization, but prosperousamerica.org, not to be confused with Americans for Prosperity, which has happened. And if you do nothing else as a listener, call your congressman and tell him to oppose Fast Track.
Very good. And actually, I'd like to second that very strongly and also add, when you call, inquire what your congressman's position is. Because if they are firmly opposed to Fast Track, you can call other national leaders like Nancy Pelosi, for example, who leads, you know, is the minority leader of all of the Congress, and you could call her. And urge her to oppose Fast Track. And you can call back every day. It's not even I have to call once in my lifetime on this. And if you find out that your representative is going to vote for Fast Track, you know, I strongly encourage you to go by the office, to visit, to bring other people, to get other people to call, because a lot of people are going back and forth or equivocal around this. So you can do a lot to make sure this goes the right way. Thank you so much, Michael Stumo. This has just been an incredible education for all of us who have been listening to this today. And, you know, Prosperous America is a, you know, the Coalition for Prosperous America. I mean, that's what we all want, is a prosperous America. And thank you so much for sharing with us today, Michael, what we need to do to get there and what we need, the path we need to avoid to make that, you know, make prosperity in America a thing of the past and, you know, keep it in our future by stepping up and doing the right thing right now, which is stopping this Fast Track vote that's upcoming in Congress, you know, getting people to vote no on Fast Track so that we can really examine these treaties and hopefully turn the situation around. Thank you so much for being with us today as our special guest on Connect the Dots, Michael.
My pleasure.
And it's been terrific having you. And thank you, listeners. Have a great week. Come back next week for the next edition of Connect the Dots every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Well, well, well.